Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host, and today we are very happy to have with us Professor Gillian Straker, all the way from Australia, where it is now, we're recording, it's about 4 p.m. in New York City and 6 a.m. her time. So we welcome you to the show, and we're very pleased to finally make this happen. I want to, before the interview gets started, I want to do a couple of things. First of all, I want to just give people a bit of Jill's sort of bio, and I'm going to do that now, and then I'm going to say a couple of words about how we came to do this interview, which is going to be a little bit different than what I've done in the past, and you'll learn why in a moment. So Gillian Straker is a clinical professor in the School of Psychology at Sydney University, and she's also a visiting research professor at the University, Jill, you'll correct my pronunciation, I would say of the Witwatersrand in South Africa?
Perfect.
Is that okay? Oh, wonderful. Okay, good. She's also a psychoanalytic psychotherapist and supervisor and has a private practice. She's co-director for the Center for Applied Studies in Psychotherapy and Counseling. I'm assuming that's in Sydney, Jill. Is that correct? Okay. And she's also involved in several local and international training programs. I think that's probably an understatement, by the way. She's a member of the New South Wales Institute for Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy and the International Association of Relational Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy, as well as the Australian Centre of Psychoanalysis, which is a Lacanian institute. So your influences, her influences are, I think, pretty vast. Jill has broad experience, for sure, working in the area of post-traumatic and continuing traumatic stress. She's worked with, you'll have to tell us, what is UNHCR? That's United Nations Human...
what is UNHCR? Refugees. Human Commission on Refugees.
Great. On programs for survivors of torture and detention. She was involved in providing counseling services to individuals on the run from the apartheid state and has published numerous articles in the fields of post-traumatic and continuous traumatic stress, whiteness, peace studies, and spirituality. She's published two books, Faces in the Revolution, which was co-authored with the Sanctuary's counseling team. And most recently, she's published a book called The Talking Cure, co-written with a Dr. Jackie Winship. And currently, she's also doing something that is really incredibly interesting, as I've been running a podcast for a long time, with Rachel Burton and Andy Gieves. She has created a podcast series, and it's entitled, I love the title, Three Associating. That's as in the numeral, Three Associating. And I've certainly listened to it. I encourage people to listen to it. It's totally unique. It's a podcast that focuses on, it's a live supervision, if you will, that one gets to listen in and listen to Jill work with clinicians on their cases. And it's really, there's nothing, as far as I know, there's nothing out there. Nothing out there like it. So, that's a lot. So Jill, welcome to the program. And, so it's been a long time in bringing you here. And I guess one more thing, just for the listeners, usually we do a book. You'd be expecting that I would talk about the most recent book, The Talking Cure, which was published really recently. Jill, when was it published? Published in 2019, yes? Yeah, so it's published really recent, sort of pandemic publishing. I was going to initially do this book, which is a book that is for people who, like a person on, I think, Jill, a person on the street who's thinking maybe I should go into therapy should definitely run into this book. Would you say?
Yeah, exactly. It was written for the lay public, yep, to try and encourage them to have psychotherapy other than more behaviorally oriented, thinking about interiority is the way I would just summarize it. Yep.
It's a very, it's one of those reads that, I found myself like really, going, oh yeah, yeah, tell this story. Oh yeah, here's this story of this sort of a complex, and while I liked the book very much, because for those who have been listening to the program for the past year, that I've interviewed M. Fakhri Davids on his book, Internal Racism, and Sheldon George on Trauma and Race, and then Neil Altman on White Privilege. And part of, sort of my exploration and thinking about what does psychoanalysis have to say about racism. And so I've been quite aware of Jill's work. And I said, listen, I'd like to talk to you about 21 articles that you've written over the last 20 something years. And so listeners, this is a new departure. We are now in New Books in Psychoanalysis doing new books and also new articles and old articles in psychoanalysis. So it's a brave new moment in the podcast. Usually, Jill, we ask what motivated you to write the book, but I've been trying to craft a little bit of a different question. And you were working as a clinician in South Africa during apartheid. And I guess the question that came to mind is to begin is I don't want to say this in a way, like not just simply what was your experience, but how has your experience of living in South Africa during apartheid impacted your thinking as a psychoanalytically informed clinician? How about that?
Well, I'll try my best, Tracy. It's sort of got to do with the evolution of myself as a person as much as kind of an evolution of thinking psychoanalytically. But first of all, I did want to say thank you, and I am quite honored that I'm the first person in a different format. And to say, Tracy, that I've really enjoyed listening to your style of interviewing and your podcasts, and I really mean that. And also, I've enjoyed our humor in the emails, so just to note that.
Yes.
And perhaps I will start with the question you usually ask because it's relevant and to the point. I think that my first book, which was Faces in the Revolution, on the first overt level I wrote because that particular group wanted an oral history to be written of their particular experiences as township youth who were very involved in the revolution and basically gave up their education, gave up a huge amount of their lives. Many of them were illiterate in order to be in the revolutionary struggle. So I think on the overt level, that was part of it, that there was a desire. Also, I was trying to smuggle in some sort of addressing of the trauma that group had experienced because they had been witness to their leader being killed. They'd been taken to a community center which had been invaded. And I first became involved by being asked to intervene because they were very disrupted. And as often happens with trauma, were in a state of externalizing all their trauma in a lot of aggression. And they were equally not safe. So I began my work with them and developed a long-term relationship with them. So as I say, on the first level, it was about documenting the experience. But truthfully, I think it was around trying to make some sense of the chaos inside of myself that was stimulated by suddenly going from being a kind of middle-class South African wandering down shaded streets to thinking with a group about matters of life and death. And I think I also wanted to somehow humanize the group because even in the liberal press, they were being spoken of as a lost generation or brutalized. So I think that was my overt reason, but I think the covert reason had much more to do with trying to order some chaos, perhaps, within myself. So that's how it starts. But my journey didn't start there, really, Tracy. My journey actually started in America, where I had fled at the time of the youth rebellion and the youth push, which was the beginning, actually, of the real demise of apartheid. And while I had recognized at some level abstractly, yes, that apartheid was wrong, my parents at an abstract level also felt that it was wrong, but I really had tuned out the significance of what it actually meant for people at the receiving end of it. And I honestly think I tuned it out more than most. And I think that I came to it later than many of the comrades that I worked with once I went back. Well, when I was in America and I had sufficient distance and also with wonderful people there who gently interrogated me about my position and South Africa, I think I began to become capable of tuning in the significance of it at a visceral personal level, not just as an abstract idea that apartheid was wrong. And that led me, even though I was on track in America to get a green card and to immigrate, after a lot of discerning, I felt that I really needed to go back and to take responsibility for the fact that I had lived and benefited in the society. And I did go back. And I think that if I were to say, and still to this day, the concept that I feel was most helpful in my understanding myself, and I can only in a way talk for myself because I don't want to homogenize all whites or all blacks or all anybody for that matter. But I think Talion's law, the Kleinian idea of Talion's law, that I really thought about the kinds of things that might have been said in my environment, in my home, you know, about a fear of black people and what might happen, you know, if there was a revolution. And I really became aware that it was an externalization of our own fear, of our own aggression, the damage that we had done to the other, and the fantasy of that returning in sort of retaliation, which we then, I think, acted in terms of that fantasy. So Talion's law for me is a very helpful way of thinking about fear of the other, which is really fear of the enemy within, if I could put it that way. So that was really important to me. And, you know, of course, if you became involved in opposing apartheid, you would have realistically based fear, which I think that as whites, one did have if you engaged of the state, because it was quite brutal. And I think there was also another enemy within, which was one's fear that if one articulated ideas against the dominant ideology, which at that point was apartheid, that you would be ostracized. Less so perhaps in my own case, but I certainly experienced it. And, you know, I think that we can all identify with it, even in our current political situation, the in-groups and out-groups. So I think that if you want to interrupt me, Tracy, do, because that's, you know, like the first part of a long journey. So I don't
know. I'm enjoying listening. I think it's keep, please keep talking.
Okay.
As you wish, absolutely.
So I think that's, you know, dissociation, having the real privilege of containment and the idea of a third when I was in America that helped me to understand that, and then being able to go a bit deeper and coming up against Talion's law within myself. And Then I think a next very key moment for me was when I was working with a young man who was very, very active in the struggle. And in a moment of, I think, confiding at that point, which was unusual for him because he was quite defended, and I think he saw and I saw that to some extent he was educating me, and indeed he was, because it was a world that was completely foreign to me, his world in the township, in massive oppression, deprivation, also a conflict within different groups because the apartheid state was fostering the so-called black-on-black violence. Mm-hmm. But he confided in me that he had been involved in the brutal killing of a...
Stanley.
Yes, Stanley. Of a person who was sort of thought to be an informer and had informed to the police, they thought, about an attack that the comrades in the township were planning. And the police had booby-trapped the grenades and their comrades were killed. And this was a reprisal. And it was very brutal because it was in the days of necklacing, which was putting a tire around the person's neck, filling it with petrol and setting it alight. And this was an enormous shock. I can still actually remember the complete, I think you've spoken in one of your interviews of a white blank psychosis. Well, I think that overtook me in that moment. And then in retrospect, when I thought about it, I thought how much I had once again been out of touch with myself and had exported certain responsibilities into Stanley for the future. I think I'd idealized him. I think I'd disowned my own responsibility. Mm-hmm. I was much younger then, but I was still older than him. So something about the sort of generational divide and how to navigate that at a time at which actually the youth were very much challenging the older generation, their own parents, you know, not so much having that much to do with white people, but still there was a big generational issue going on in the township. And I found that when I really thought about it, that I had allied with him in a way which was positive to take the course forward, but not in another way of disowning perhaps some of the generational issues and also disowning certain responsibility and agency. So, and he and I then had to grapple very much with difference and how to stay connected despite difference, and that was challenging. Yes, Tracy, you sound like you want to say something.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking of several of the articles that you've written. I'm thinking of the one, what's it called, Race for Cover. And in that article, I think it's in that article where you talk about the group that you were working with, the, you know, anti-apartheid group, and of, you know, amongst the, in the group, the white activists and participants, that the tendency was to there could be a fetishization of the black activists. And it was a question that I have somewhere here where I just thought it was very important when thinking about the like a black-white clinical couple, is that, you know, I've noticed in myself, I've certainly noticed in white supervisees I work with who have black patients, is like, well, do your black patients get to have destructive parts? Do they get to have really, you know, like serious, you know, unconscious conflicts, or do they have to, you know, does that have to be tiptoed around? How to be the white analyst talking to a black patient about aspects of themselves that they may seek to disavow, and we sort of, you know, in an attempt to be a good white, I think that's a term you use. It's, we would say good whites here, but a good white, and, you know, just sort of collude. And I really thought that I actually taught that article, alongside, I sent you the syllabus. I'm trying to remember. Alongside Norman Mailer's the white Negro, which is a real piece of work about the fantasy of, you know, what the black man has that the white man wants is really what the white man has imputed, to the black man and disavowed himself. Anyway, I don't know where I've taken us with that recollection, but it's nice to be able to say something to you about that, because it's a really excellent essay on disavowal and fetishization. And it's a more Freudian for you, more classically Freudian use, is in reading you, Jill, you know, so Jill spoke about her experience of dissociation before and coming to America as sort of a moment where whatever had not been formulated into thought began to formulate into thought about the situation, about apartheid, about the brutalization and dehumanization. And Jill and I had an exchange, I don't know when it was, but it was maybe in the summer. I was like, well, I really actually never understood dissociation as well as when you said something like, it's like the water you're swimming in that you don't even, do you remember?
Yes, I do.
Can you articulate it for those who don't understand dissociation, who are more, you know, there are some who still exist, I think, so I can't be alone. So what, could you do that? Could you talk to us about dissociation and water?
Well, I think particularly as a child, we just accept to some extent where we are. Of course, if it's terrible and we're traumatized or something, we might right there and then perhaps have some awareness of two worlds. But I think in a situation like apartheid, where I think, and this is another concept I'd like to put in there, I think the absolute pernicious thing about it is the internalization of hierarchies of superiority and inferiority. And I think that is something that you are just swimming in that water. So you don't really know that that's what you're internalizing until I got out of that water and went to America, which was like standing on the land and looking back and saying, oh yeah, I was actually in water, and it's pretty awful water, but I didn't really know I was swimming in it.
It was completely toxic, but I wasn't poisoned.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because it's for me, dissociation is tuning out something that you sort of have at the periphery of your awareness. So, as I said, abstractly, yes, apartheid was wrong, but did I tune in the significance of that for an individual on the other side of it? No, I didn't. And, you know, I think to my cost. And then I think that later I could also see that apart from the dissociation, there were other factors involved, like Italian's law, repressing my own damage that was being done to others, and then fearing that it would come back, you know, to me or to us as a group. So that's why I think, Tracy, I've tried to study many frameworks, because I think we have so few tools that, you know, it's not for me either Klein or Freud or relational. It's what can we kind of gain from each of them to understand something. I don't know if that explained the dissociation in the way you were hoping.
No. I mean, I found it very helpful. And it's like, you know, obviously it's not the same as repression, you know, which I've known. But it was more something about it, like actually how you described it helped to help me to formulate and to feel my way into it, which I really hadn't felt my way into what dissociation, and I was like, oh yeah, of course I know about dissociation. Like I know it, I live it. You know what I mean? I can, there's moments where one emerges from it and, you know, it's as if, it's, I mean, I know what the process is, but I had never really read anything. It was just a little email exchange. And I was like, oh, there it is. Finally, it's been written about in a way that I could just get it. But, you know, just what's coming to mind as you're talking, what's interesting is that how, you know, I'm just about to be 59 years old and next weekend, actually. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, you know, when I came of age on the college campuses here in America in the 80s, there was so much furor, right, about South Africa. But I remember, I mean, I was not very involved with it. I was more involved with, like, you know, feminist activism, I think, at the time, as an old women's studies major and all this. But I remember American friends saying, you know, what the South Africans, you know, that are here, they're like, well, why are you so concerned about South Africa? So the dissociation maybe is, you know, the focus on the problem of racism all the way over in South Africa rather than the problem of racism on the campus itself, in the town itself, in the city itself, in the country itself, in America itself. So it sounds like a similar process.
I think that's exactly right, Tracy. Yeah,
mm-hmm. the blind spot. I want to ask you a question. This is a little, I don't know, maybe you don't have an answer to it, but are you familiar? So you're the second South African analyst from someone raised in South Africa and formed in part as a clinician in South Africa. The other person is Fakhri Davids, mm-hmm. who trained at the British Psychoanalytic and also left South Africa. I like Fakhri's work very much, and yet it seems that he's cited almost nowhere. Now, you might not want to answer this question, but do you have any thoughts about this? Do you know his work? Are you familiar with his thinking? His book, Internal Racism?
I certainly am, Tracy. I do know his work. I think he's a lovely person. In fact, he was in Cape Town, I think, when I was in Johannesburg in the bad old days. So, I do know him. I do know his work. And in fact, I would love at some point to have a dialogue with Fakhri, because I just think he's incredibly insightful and thoughtful. I do have some differences, perhaps, around Rosenfeld. I'm not sure if you picked it up in the article I wrote in the 90s after going to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because that was the next kind of moment in which it was a confrontation with pure cruelty, sadism, when one actually listened to the testimony of the perpetrators. And in that article, I spoke about Rosenfeld's gang, which I think that Fakhri has taken up in terms of seeing it as a normal part of the mind. And I'm not totally sure that I would go with that. I feel that he's made an amazing contribution. But when he talks, for example, about stranger anxiety, in the South African context, black people actually wouldn't have been strangers. They would have been incredibly familiar at 6 or 8 months, more like intimate strangers than the others. So I think that complicates it a bit. I certainly agreed with his idea, and we know it's true, the doll identification. But I guess I see it in terms of those tropes of superiority, inferiority, which were so pernicious in the institution of the domestic black childcare worker. But I do think in a certain way also pertains to feminism. So there are many areas in which I would overlap with him. And I also think it's fantastic that he's actually brought this forward for us to be able to think about. But I must say, I went to Rosenfeld when it was more extreme because of Rosenfeld's idea that we really invest in the bad aspects of ourselves and we idealize those aspects of omnipotence, self-sufficiency, cruelty, which I see very much in white supremacism, for example, and Sheldon George's idea of race as metaphor, which and he relates it to the Afro-pessimists. I mean, I couldn't go there because not my area, but it did seem to me to make a lot of sense. And I kind of felt that when we, I think I possibly would reserve still Rosenfeld for a more extreme form, but as we know, the paranoid schizoid position is a position, and we can all move into it and move out of it, and maybe there are indeed moments when we move into the Rosenfeld gang. But I'd love to have a discussion with Fakhri, and why he's not quoted.
It's as if, I mean, his book is 11 years old, and there's, like, I did a citation search the other day. He's cited, like, by three authors. It's true, and it's been reviewed three times. I mean, I want to get back to you, but it is, you know,
I agree.
Because it's within it's a psychoanalytic text through and through. But I think in listening to you speak now, what's incredible and really admirable is not really, it's like a dumb word, but you are. In reading you, one is in, you feel you're in the hands of a person who's really read a lot. Now, you just described Rosenfeld, the gang leader. That's the Life and Death Instincts article, which I just am assigning somewhere in the next 2 weeks. But I was just thinking, like, oh, you just picked that up, and oh, now we're on to Sheldon George. Would you say that your formation, and I'm using that term decidedly, I get the sense from reading, you know, throughout your articles that your training was, in many respects, once you became a psychologist and you were initially a behaviorist, it was like the only game in town, I guess, right? You know, that you could, that you've created in a sort of the Lacanian sense, you've done a formation. Rather than a proper, sign up for training and 4 years later we call you a psychoanalyst, or I'm a little confused about how you know so much. And my sense is you're not institute trained, which if that's the case, I really admire that. So can you fill that in a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, as you say, when I started, not even cognitive behavior therapy. Behavior therapy was the only game in town. And yes, I always sort of found it absolutely bizarre that we could have an idea of a stimulus, empty box response. No kidding. That's what we were taught. Nothing in between. Stimulus, empty box, i.e. person, response. Anyway. Again, America came to my rescue. We had a man called Dick Rock. I don't even know if he's still around. He was a visiting lecturer from the States and an existentialist. And wow, it was such a breath of fresh air. So I kind of grabbed onto that and read all the existentialists and became passionate for it. Freud, of course, was totally trashed, as was the... how things worked in that time. And I'm afraid I imbibed that ideology both around Freud and Klein and all the psychoanalysts. But when I went to work in a children's unit, which I did, and I was playing in the doll's house with kids, and lo and behold, you know, the little boys were locking their dads in the bathroom and, you know, going off with their mothers. And I started to think, oh my God, there's got to be something about this. So,
That's funny.
But I then became, you know, interested and intrigued and started to read a lot. That was before I actually left South Africa and went to America. And then when I came back, to be honest, my psychoanalytic reading and studying was totally truncated because it really was a time of action. We weren't had much time to be thinking. One was sort of in crisis. Then when I got involved at the university, which I did.
Wait, can I interrupt you one second? Which is also, Jill Wrights did this incredible research about the ways in which thinking during wartime, I forget the title of the article, but it's Thinking Under Fire. Yeah, that you know, sort of looking at like the ways in which thought can be sort of predictably derailed. And that was a study of your colleagues. Is that correct?
Well, myself very much, myself and my colleagues, as I said. Mm-hmm. So it was me and my group that was kind enough to talk to me, but it reflects myself very much. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think our thinking was directed only toward the goal, which was to try to depose the apartheid state. And so, well, group psychology and the ego, when I think reflecting back on it, you know, how hard it was to have a mind of your own and how you have to some extent give up your own mind because you have to be part of a group if you're going to leverage change. Mm-hmm. So during that time, that was truncated. But once I was at the university and had some responsibility for training, I started to again sort of think psychoanalytically and think about how can we make psychoanalytic ways of thinking more accessible, because we can't be doing, you know, one-to-one work on the couch. So I then at that point went in two directions. One was community psychology and the other was that I went to the Tavistock and I did a training in brief term psychoanalytic psychotherapy, David Madden, and thought, how can we think psychoanalytically but not necessarily work in the kind of conventional way?
Sure.
And so then when I came back to South Africa, at that point it was trying to set up services in the township in a broader way. And there were many, many colleagues that were helping in that, the sanctuary's counseling team, the detainee support services. So there was a lot of fertile discussion, even though I think we were struggling to think. So yes, I did spend quite considerable time going back and forth to the Tavistock in the times that I could. But yes, when I came to Australia, there was a thought, did I actually want to do a training? And I decided, actually, I didn't, because I felt that there's something about it potentially that narrows the focus, which I felt unwilling to do. In Australia, the kind of zeitgeist was more towards self-psychology, and through self-psychology, I became quite involved in relational. And I've got friends who are ex-South Africans who are very involved in relational, so that kind of led me there. And also, Lacanian thinking is quite strong in Sydney, and that totally fascinated me. I want to say one thing, which is maybe a little bit kind of rude over the airways, but one of the things.
Just say anything is my policy, so go ahead. All right.
I think that the joy of being in a society which is very, very privileged is that you can have the luxury of intellectual wank, so to speak, without having to pay a huge price in guilt, which is not the case if you are in a place like South Africa, which I totally still love and feel committed to. And I tell you this, the people there Tracy, I honestly mean this, like 10 years, 15 years ahead of the curve in thinking about race. So, you know, people like Norman Duncan who and Garth Stevens, both of whom are black people, who actually took over the running of the department I was in. Super smart, Jill Eagle, who's also done a lot of research.
Yes.
And, you know, they're pretty amazing in how they're thinking and formulating a way forward now that you know, one is reaping the whirlwind in so many ways and how
yes.
to think about it. So
yes.
that's
yes.
perhaps all I'll say now, but yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, it brings to mind, I mean, you know, what's taking place in, you know, in analytic training in America since 2020, since the murder of George Floyd. It's like a, you know, there's sort of a manic rush to action and an attempt to, you know, there's like a fear of a black planet, you know, at many institutes. It's like, well, we want to have black students. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Absolutely, we do. We want black students. So this is like the conversation, I mean, not simply where I am, but like at every institute, you know, friends across, we want black, but, and I always say, but how many will be too many?
Well,
how many black students will be too many? And and somehow that I think connects to you know, sort of this somehow what you just said before brought that to mind. It's like, and so the anxiety, like working through the anxiety and like studying, learning from South Africa, if you want to, it's there, you know, like learning from South Africa is you know, as you say, 15 years out from where things are, certainly in the United States.
And that is so familiar to me, even working at the university during the apartheid years. Too many was not very many, I found. And if one pushed against it, then that whole thing about having to fight with the enemy within, because then you are going against the dominant ideology. There's a price to pay in a certain ostracism and alienation. So I just think it's so, one has to do it, but I'm just looking at all the kinds of things that come
in.
The fallout, the
ways in which I think people here in the States who have been very active in trying to move the needle at different psychoanalytic institutes, you know, it's like white colleagues talking to white colleagues, and those conversations, you know, people, it's overwhelming how important it is to white psychoanalysts that black people remain on the outskirts, even though I'm not a racist, you know, I'm certainly not a racist, but there's a constant, the feelings are so intense. Can we have them? Can we talk about them? Can we know them? Or do we just run and, you know, turn our heads in, you know, in the sand? It's easier to pretend that this will just solve, as Fokker David says something wonderful. There's plenty of racism, but there are no racists. You can't find a racist for miles, but racism continues. It's really
I think that returns me to the idea of the fetish, because I think on the one hand there's what you're talking about, which, you know, is the fear of the black planet, as you put it. But I think on the other side is something you referred to earlier, and I think that to me comes in very, very often around the fetishization and the need to be seen as the good person, as the good white, as the person who isn't racist.
And
something within that, for me, the fetish is a denial of limitation. And that's why I do value the fact that if I were to say where I've spent most time sort of studying, it probably is in the Lacanian. And as you say, in Lacan, it's a formation rather than a training in a sort of formal sense. I've spent a lot of time in that. And I do like that idea of, you know, how we try to paper over the kind of hole at the center of being and how we do use others to do it. And I think that on the one hand, there's this terrible fear that we'll be politically incorrect. And here I definitely agree with Fakhri that why are we so worried about being politically incorrect unless underneath there's something that we haven't yet resolved? And then on the other hand, there's kind of, well, I think it's Talion's law, that fear, that our own damage that we've done to the other, we fear that it will return to us in some form.
Well, right, or as the black activist Stokely Carmichael from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee once said, the chickens are going to come home to roost, which I think is which is also a reference to Talion's law. You know, when I was preparing for the interview, there's so many different places to go, but I did something funny I've never done before. I wrote, like, do you know the work of Raymond Williams, the critical British critical theorist at all, sort of around the sort of a I guess a peer, maybe a little bit older than Stuart Hall, and yeah, I just love his work, and so I wrote Keywords with Jillian because I love that book, you know, Raymond Williams Keywords, and I wrote some keywords. I just want to. I'm going to read them out loud. Voice. The word voice is very important in your writing. Of course, the word dissociation and trauma. I noticed the word the term procedural memory, the term capacity to think, disavowal and fetish we've been talking about. Anti-analytic third we have to get to. Morality. Then it was Bourdieu, Baba, Butler, beneficiary, and shame. Those were the words that, you know, at the end of reading everything and rereading, I said, what are the words that are with me? And of course, this says a lot, more about me than about you, but I do think that these, that no, these words do.
I think you're right. They do recur.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. So it's sort of like an objective countertransference. Like I picked up something real, you think? Okay.
Insofar as any of us can be objective, yes, Tracy, I do think
yes,
so.
Yes, yes, yes. Like many people, if they read your articles, you know, once or twice, they would come up with this. Will you talk to us about this? This, to my mind, your original theoretical contribution is clearly the article on the anti-analytic third, in which you look at the work of several colleagues. We're going to go over 50 minutes, guys, so that's how it's going to go. But that you look at the work of, in sort of a clinical moment, in the work of Neil Altman, clinical moment in the work of Ken Corbett, and I had the feeling that you were taken by these clinical representations of sort of noxious social discourse that enters the room, the clinical encounter, and throws everything, throws the analyst out of their seat, out of their analytic chair. Can you talk to us about the anti-analytic third? I think it's a great concept. We need it.
Well, I think I introduced it in the light, well, not in the light of, because I hadn't heard you say it, but it goes along with something that I have heard you say, which is about how important it is for us to have words which detoxify our shame about, you know, being entangled in racism or homophobia or sexism. Because once we sort of have a concept or a word that can kind of be a life raft, which allows us to grab onto it and think. And, you know, the third has always been valorized as something very positive. And of course, there are many ways of thinking about the third. Jessica Benjamin's got at least three right there. But I think that the third is something that transcends the couple. But when it transcends the couple, then it's a noxious ideology that both of them are actually embroiled in, but perhaps from different positions. it will come into the room and be there in hidden ways until suddenly something happens to explode it. You know, the one person will indicate to the other something about their race or their sexuality. And it really isn't about something so much personal that you learned from your mother and father. You actually learned it in the water that you swim in, to go back to that. And you kind of imbibed it through osmosis, so which is the other way I think about how we dissociate. We imbibe it through osmosis. A procedural memory is like, you know, when you learn how to ride a bicycle, you can't describe how you ride the bicycle, but you know how to ride the bicycle. It's in your procedure how to be with that object. And I think that we imbibe through the ideology how to be with the racial other, the gendered other, the person with a different sexual orientation. And we're not even aware of it until the person at the other side of that discourse does something to challenge it, or you do something that makes it impossible for them not to challenge you, something like that. But I wanted a word so that we could say, okay, I'm in an anti-analytic third, and not go down a shame hole.
Well, it's sort of, right, so you know, like you can now know it when you see it, rather than not be able to see it and then bring bring language around it, so that there can be there's a way. I mean, there's a way out, because it's just this collapse. You know, the case of Neil Altman and his patient who's black, and the patient's not paying, and Neil's thinking, oh God, I don't want to push for more money, for the money to be paid, because oh God, well, he's black and I'm Jewish, and like, and it's like, okay, well, what's actually what is the patient actually like? My thought when I read that, I interviewed Neil in that book years ago, and I was like, I don't know if I said this to him. I was like, well, your patient obviously is has a full negative transference and has very hateful feelings towards you that they're expressing about by not by giving you bounce checks, and he just happens to be black.
Exactly, Tracy.
Black people can express their hatred for the analytic process by not paying. Yes.
Yes. And then when we get, he was so totally in an anti-analytic third, as we all get into, because he was immersed in the race discourse, both around Jewish and black. And so he couldn't see exactly what you're saying. Well, the person's a person, and they're also going to have their own hateful feelings.
And, totally.
And that goes to also the idea of political correctness, because in that moment, one wants to be politically correct.
Right, right, right. Or like you, you know, your the experience which you detail, you know, about the story of Stanley and the necklacing, and it's it was interesting, because it's like, okay, so I kept asking myself, well, why is he bringing this in? What does he want from Jill?
Well, exactly. And if you think that I could have thought about that in that moment,
I would be wrong.
Very.
Wouldn't be the first time. No. But it's like, God. to get back to that place, right? It's like,
exactly.
You know, exactly. It's crucial, because otherwise, you know, you really, you can't, I mean, as a white clinician, you can't have black patients unless you can hold on to your understanding, you know, like working with supervisees, you're like, well, I once actually had a black man who was in a group with me, and he didn't pay. And, you know, I would discuss in the group, well, what are you trying to tell me by not paying? Oh, you shouldn't bring that up. You're humiliating him and he's black. And I said, well, I said he's expressing some negative feelings toward me because I'm working for money and I'm not being paid, and I want to know why he wants me to work for free. And, you know, and it was
well, you're 100% right, and you weren't in an anti-analytic third. You were
Right. It was really And people were really upset. The white people in the group were very upset with me that I was not. And I said, well, he's black and he's not paying me. Okay. Yes. And why does he want me to suffer? Why does he not want me to be able to buy food? What's going on?
Yes, exactly. So
yeah,
you were definitely thinking in that situation, Tracy. I can assure you with Stanley, all thought had fled in that particular moment.
Well, no, I don't know what I would have done with Stanley. I would have been, because you'd seen it on television too, right? I saw that on television.
I think you did. It was quintessential because of that terrible moment where.
That's right.
She's in the death situation, but she's worried about her dress going up. It was terrible.
Right.
It was absolutely
excruciating.
Awful. Yeah.
That detail was like so excruciating. Mm. I just threw the article across the room. I can't go any further right now. I was like, oh, I forgot. There's that detail. It was like so uncomfortable, you know, and like oof, and it stayed. And listen, I think we have to stop. I mean, I don't know. There's so much more to say. I'm supposed to go get a pedicure. I'm going to be frank.
Well, that sounds like a very important thing to do after we've had such intense and deep discussion. The pedicure sounds exactly what's needed, Jason.
I mean, there's a lot more to talk. We didn't even get to the article. My God, that... You're responding to the most recent spate of articles from Dialogues, the three clinicians in training writing about their impasses with Black clinicians in training in South Africa writing about their treatments with white analysts and the racial conflicts. Your response to it is good, but. I want to highlight that for the listeners. Get your hands on that because it's so rare for people to write about their treatments while they're in training, first of all. And then the ways in which these white analysts and these black patients try to work together to reckon with the legacy of racism in South Africa and all the different, and what's so interesting, Jill, I'm sure you picked up on this right away, or I'm sure you know this already, as you say, in South Africa, it's 15 years ahead of the game in thinking about racism, is the black clinicians in training were worried about being.
Yes. And that's the anti-analytic third, because we are in a racist discourse. We occupying, you know, if you think about abuse, you internalize the abuser and the abused, and it's the same thing. And that's what I mean by the anti-analytic third, that yes, the fear of being perceived as racist or being racist, you can't escape it if the water you've swum in is that discourse. So but I'm delighted that you've drawn attention to that article.
It's super unique.
It. And it's super unique. And I do agree with you. If people can read it, they should.
They should. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we'll be in touch. I recommend to the listeners to check out the podcast, Three Associating. THREE Associating, and it's a perfect listen for when you're going for a morning walk. That's how I first encountered it. I took a morning walk, and I was like, "Wow, where am I?" It's a little bit like the primal scene, I have to say, but that's okay.
Oh, Tracy, I do hope we're in contact. I love your humor. And I've really, really enjoyed being in dialogue with you.
I've enjoyed it so much too. All right. And dear listeners, thanks for tuning in as always. And signing off for now, it's Tracy Morgan saying goodbye till next time. And thanks so much, Jillian Straker, for being with us.
Thanks, Tracy.